You can see Reese anytime you want. You know how much she loves you. The two of them swayed slightly, Mrs. Parsons stiffly as if she was still unsure of her welcome, and Mama as if she could barely hold in all the other things she wanted to say. Grandma Parsons's brother kept his face turned away, smoking out the window of his truck. I kept close to Mama and watched the muscles in his neck jump as the two women sniffed and cleared their throats. Well, Mrs. Parsons licked her lips. Maybe I'll just come in a minute, have a little water before we start back. You could stay for dinner. Mama's face was flushed red and getting darker as I watched. Well, no, we couldn't do that. Mrs. Parsons glanced over at her brother's shoulder, but he didn't turn to look at her. We do have to get back. I'll just stay a minute or two. It wasn't until she was sitting on Mama's Sears sofa, with Reese drawn up between her legs and the envelope with the money from the insurance passed over to Mama, that Grandma Parsons relaxed a little. She got her brush out so she could pull the tangles out of Reese's white blonde hair and keep her hands busy. Your hair was red as fire when you were born, she told Reese. Now it's as white as your daddy's was. Reese liked being told she looked like her daddy, and she kept his picture hidden in her underwear drawer where Daddy Glenn wouldn't see it and get his feelings hurt. Now and then, I'd go get it out myself, looking into that grinning boy's face that had nothing to do with me, and get all hot and tight with jealousy. Lyle had been as pretty as a girl, and so white blonde he could have been a model in magazines. Reese had hair as fine as Lyle's, and a smile that came easy and fast. But she had, too, the boatwright's narrow face and long, skinny neck. Still, I envied the way she could look from that picture to Mama's face, to Grandma Parsons's bent shoulders, and guess how she might still change before she grew up. She had another family, another side of herself to think about, something more than Mama and me and the boatwrights. Reese could choose something different for herself and be someone else altogether. Oh, Reese'll likely go dark. Mama spoke hesitantly, as if she didn't want to argue, but didn't want to chance any misunderstanding. Might even go red again. She might, but she might not. Among our people, hair stays blonde sometimes. Mrs. Parsons tried to smile at Mama, but her face didn't soften until she looked down at Reese. I was sitting on the arm of the sofa next to Mama, where I could look out the window to see the waiting truck and the empty road all the way up to the next intersection. I kept listening for the sound of the Pontiac, hoping not to hear it. Daddy Glenn might come home while Mrs. Parsons was still here, and I knew Mama was worried about that, her hands pulling again at her belt loops nervously. Mrs. Parsons looked over at Mama's hands, and then spoke carefully. That money's all there's gonna be, I'm afraid. My property ain't worth much, and truth is, I signed it over to Matthew just after my boys died. Matthew's promised to take care of me, and I trust that he will. Thing is, Lyle didn't have no title to the land, and no other insurance as far as we know. Mama shook her head once, and looked up directly into Mrs. Parsons' face. I know he didn't have nothing, she said. I knew that when he died, and it's never mattered to me. Didn't expect his death benefit, to tell you the truth. Thought he wasn't entitled to nothing from the army. Her face looked sad, but not so stiff as it had. Mrs. Parsons' face was a match for hers. I wish you would get lots and lots of money from the insurance. Reese wiggled happily in Grandma Parsons's arms and beamed at all of us. Oh, I don't need no money, child. Grandma Parsons laughed and pushed herself up off the couch. I'm afraid I've got to get going, Annie. It's a long trip for me to get home. I looked closely at Mama to see if she had heard the old woman say her name, but Mama was already up and reaching for Mrs. Parsons's glass. Don't you want more? Mama was saying as she headed for the kitchen. Mrs. Parsons shook her head and said no while hanging on to Reese. I saw Mama's shoulders relax a little as she turned to come back to us. The road outside was still quiet. Grandma Parsons bent over to hug Reese tightly one more time. You just remember, honey. I got the best of Lyle when I got you, she told her. That sounded strange to me, as if she'd hatched my baby sister herself off her boy's dead frame. But Reese grinned like a princess and wiggled her toes into the nap of the rug. She followed Grandma Parsons out to the truck, begging her to stay over. "Reese, be good," Mama told her. "You can see your grandma next month when we go up to her place." "You will come?" Mrs. Parsons looked sad and nervous all over again. "We'll come." Mama's voice was emphatic, but I saw her eyes flick once up the road as she spoke. Mrs. Parsons nodded brusquely and climbed in the truck. Her brother never said a word, just started the engine and put it in gear. Reese was waving fiercely even before Matthew gunned the engine. I saw Mrs. Parsons wipe her eyes as the truck pulled away. And then I saw the Pontiac come around the corner of the intersection up the road. Mama's hands curled into fists and pulled up in front of her belly. I leaned in close to her and watched the Pontiac as it edged slowly past the truck. When it reached us, Daddy Glenn leaned out the window. He looked back up the road and then over at Mama.
"You didn't sign nothing?" he demanded.
"No, Glenn." I felt Mama's hips shift awkwardly as she spoke. I looked up to watch her face as her mouth shifted into an equally awkward, stubborn smile. "You know I wouldn't sign anything that you hadn't looked at first." Daddy Glenn smiled as if that satisfied him. I let my air out carefully. Reese went on waving, though the truck was long gone. I hooked my thumbs in the belt loops of my jeans and stood by her until Mama and Daddy Glenn went back into the house.
"He's quiet, but you make Glenn mad, and he'll knock you down," Uncle Earl said good-naturedly. "Boy uses those hands of his like pickaxes."
If they thought we weren't near enough to hear, Earl and Beau would go on about Daddy Glenn's other parts.
"He gets crazy when he's angry," they laughed. "Use his dick if he can't reach you with his arms, and that'll cripple you fast enough."
I was too young to understand what they meant, why they laughed so mean and joked that no woman would ever leave Daddy Glenn, or roared and spat comparing the size of his nose to his toes to his fingers.
"Man's got a horse dick," Butch boasted to other boys. And that, I understood.
But it wasn't Daddy Glenn's sex that made me nervous. It was those hands. The restless way the fingers would flex and curl while he watched me lean close to Mama. He was always watching me, it seemed. Calling me to him whenever Mama and I would start talking. Sending me to get him a glass of iced tea or a fresh pack of cigarettes out of the freezer, where he kept his cartons so they wouldn't go stale in the summer heat. Mama told me I should show him that I loved him. But no matter how hard I tried, I never moved fast enough for him.
"That child ain't never gonna love me,"
he complained tearfully to Mama one afternoon.
"Oh, Glenn, don't say that."
Mama's voice was thin and shaky, as if she was afraid he was right.
"Bone loves you, honey."
She kissed his cheek, put her hands on either side of his face, and kissed his lips.
"She loves you. We all love you."
Daddy Glenn pulled her down to him and sighed softly as she kissed his eyelids and then rubbed her cheeks against his. I ran outside. Dinner would be late, or we'd wind up going out for hamburgers. Whenever they started kissing on the couch, they'd go in the bedroom and shut the door for an hour at least. When they came out, Daddy Glenn would be smiling and easy in his body. Mama would be sleepy-eyed and soft all over, the pink in her face fresh and delicate.
"They sure like to do it a lot,"
Reese told Alma disgustedly. But Alma just laughed.
"Everybody does, girl. Everybody does."
She swatted lightly at the seat of Reese's jeans and hugged me to her side.
"Don't make no mistake about that. Love is just about the best thing we've got that don't cost money or make you sick to your stomach. You'll see. Wait till you get a little bigger. You'll see."
Reese grimaced and wiggled uncomfortably.
"Mushy stuff," she yelled as she ran off. "All that mushy stuff. I ain't gonna have none of it."
Aunt Alma laughed carelessly. I pulled away from her and went after Reese.
It was mushy.
Mama and Daddy Glenn always hugging and rubbing on each other. But it was powerful, too. Sex. Was that what Daddy Glenn had been doing to me in the parking lot? Was it what I had started doing to myself whenever I was alone in the afternoons? I would imagine being tied up and put in a haystack while someone set the dry, stale straw ablaze. I would picture it perfectly while rocking on my hand. The daydream was about struggling to get free, while the fire burned hotter and closer. I am not sure if I came when the fire reached me, or after I had imagined escaping it, but I came. I orgasmed on my hand to the dream of fire. Daddy Glenn didn't do too well at RC Cola. He kept getting transferred to different routes or having to pay for breakage, and no matter how hard he and Mama worked, there never seemed to be enough money to pay the bills. He kept telling Mama that sooner or later his brother would pay him for all the work he'd done. But even after the offices of James Waddell DDS were open and busy, James never mentioned it. "Maybe you better ask James for that money he was going to give you," Mama finally suggested the day Daddy Glenn came home to say he'd been laid off. "I can't do that." Glenn's face seemed to squeeze in on itself as he ran his hands down from his hairline to his neck, wiping sweat off the shadowy stubble on his cheeks, and then resting his chin on his fingertips as if he were praying. "Oh, Lord. God, no, I can't do that. I'd rather starve." His eyes looked shrunken, and his chin stuck out. He looked everywhere but over at Mama where she sat. Instinctively, I put down the glass I'd been rinsing, and stepped out of the kitchen into the hall where he couldn't see me without turning around. "Glenn, honey," Mama leaned forward. "I know it's hard, but James is your brother. And baby, we're just about broke. We're not gonna have the rent if you don't get it from him. Annie, you don't understand." Daddy Glenn brought his hands up to cover his face completely. "James never said nothing about paying me at all. Hell, he never even asked for my help. I just went over there. Just did it. I never talked to him about money. Couldn't. Hell, I don't think he wanted my help nohow." Glenn brought both his fists down hard on his thighs, pounded them half a dozen times before he lifted his hands, and held them in front of him, open and extended. "I'm sorry, Annie. God, I'm so sorry." Tears pooled in his eyes and slid down his cheeks. His hands began to shake. "But it ain't just hard. It's impossible. I can't ask James for nothing. I can't ask none of them for shit. It would kill me." Mama sighed and looked away. "Well," she hesitated, and then reached out to take the hands that still hung in the air. "Well, we'll just see, then. There's other jobs. Other things we can do. We can get Earl's help to move, maybe stay with Alma. Something." She looked into Glenn's face, but whatever she hoped to see there didn't come. Her eyes kept shifting away, then back. "Oh, Glenn. Baby, it'll be all right. We'll do what we have to do. Don't you worry." After that, things seemed to move irreversibly forward. We moved, and then moved again. We lived in no one house more than 8 months. Rented houses, houses leased with an option to buy, shared houses on the city limits, brick and stucco and a promise to buy, friends of friends who knew somebody had a place standing empty, houses where the owner lived downstairs, next door, next block over, or was a friend of a man had an eye on Mama, or knew somebody who knew Daddy Glenn's daddy, or had hired one of the uncles for a short piece of work, or twice, Jesus, twice, brand new houses clean and bought on time we didn't have. Moving had no season, was all seasons, crossed time like a train with no schedule. We moved so often our mail never caught up with us. Moved sometimes before we'd even gotten properly unpacked, or I'd learned the names of all the teachers at my new school. Moving gave me a sense of time passing, and everything sliding, as if nothing could be held on to anyway. It made me feel ghostly, unreal, and unimportant, like a box that goes missing and then turns up but you realize you never needed anything in it anyway. We moved so often, Mama learned to keep the newspapers in the cardboard dish barrels, the pads and cords and sturdy boxes. "Don't throw that away. I'll need that again before long." The lines in Mama's face sank deeper with every move, every failed chance, every make do and try again.
It got to where I hated moving worse than anything. And on one hot summer day, I took a butcher knife and chopped holes in Mama's dish barrels, though all that came of it was a swat across the seat and the same old line. Don't you know how much that cost? I knew to the penny what everything cost. Late on Sunday afternoons, Mama always sat at the kitchen table counting change out of her pocketbook and juggling bills, deciding which could not be paid. Not yet, anyway. Rent was $80 a month. Too much by far when Daddy Glenn had been bringing home only $60 a week. Groceries ran as much as the rent, and that was only because we got vegetables from my aunt's gardens and discount meat from the man who sold ground beef and chicken to the diner. Then there were the clothes Reese and I were always needing, uniforms for Mama and Daddy Glenn, and shoes. Shoes were the worst. Dresses could be passed on from cousins or picked up now and then at church rummage sales, but shoes wore out or were outgrown at a frightening rate. Until the ringworm got so dangerous, we went barefoot all summer long. Though I had never complained before, suddenly I wanted new shoes. Patent leather Mary Janes. Not the cheap blue canvas sneakers I was always getting at $1.98 every 7 months or so. I wasn't a baby anymore. I was 8, then 9 years old, growing up. In 1 year, I went from compliant and quiet to loud and insistent, demanding shoes like a kid's at school wore. I wanted the ones with little tassels behind the toes, but was willing to settle for saddle Oxfords. I knew there was no chance of getting a pair of those classy little girl patent leathers with the short, pointy heels, but I looked at them longingly anyway. Mama just laughed and bought me penny loafers. "Who do you think we are, girl?" she said. "We ain't the people who buy things for show." I couldn't help it. Just for a change, I wished we could have things like other people. Wished we could complain for no reason but the pleasure of bitchin' and act like the trash we were supposed to be, instead of watching how we behaved all the time. But Mama's laughter shamed me. I wore the penny loafers with only token protest. "Don't worry about it," Mama's friend Mab told her. "Children are happier with dirt between their toes." But I noticed that her girls turned up for school in saddle Oxfords and at church in patent leather pumps and sniffed at Reese and me in our discount loafers. I wasn't sure what Mama noticed, what she could afford to notice. But when I sat with her on Sunday afternoon and watched her run down columns of figures, I suspected that she saw everything and hated it all. She'd look out at my flushed and sweating stepfather muscling the lawnmower around the edges of the yard and sigh into her coffee cup. "We ain't gonna be able to stay here," she'd say, and I knew it was about time to move again. One winter, we spent 3 months staying over with Aunt Alma, who had bought a new house on no money down. None of us expected her to keep it, and the bank filed papers on it almost as soon as we'd arrived. Something happened to me, something I had never felt before and did not know how to fight. Anger hit me like a baseball coming hard and fast off a new bat. The first day at the district school, the teacher pursed her lips and asked me my name, and that anger came around and stomped on my belly and throat. I saw tired patience in her eyes, a little shine of pity, and a contempt as old as the red dust hills I could see through the windows of her classroom. I opened my lips, but could not speak. "What's your name now, honey?" the woman asked me again, speaking slowly as if she suspected I was not quite bright. The anger lifted in me and became rage. "Roseanne," I answered as blithely as if I'd never been called anything else. I smiled at her like a Roseanne. "Roseanne Carter. My family's from Atlanta, just moved up here." I went on lightly, talking about the school I'd gone to in Atlanta, making it up as I went along, and smiling wider as she kept nodding at me. It scared me that it was so easy. My records, after all, had not caught up with me. That people thought I could be a Roseanne Carter from Atlanta, a city I had never visited. Everyone believed me, and I enjoyed a brief popularity as someone from a big city who could tell big city stories. It was astonishing. But no one in my family found out I had told such a lie. Still,
It was a relief when we moved that time, and I went off to a new school under my real name. For months after, though, I dreamed that someone came up to me and called me Roseanne, that the school records finally exposed me, or one of those teachers turned up at my new school. "Why'd you tell such a lie?" they asked me in the dream, and I could not answer them. I didn't know. I really didn't know. 1 month, Earl announced that he had finally sold that old wall hanger Beau had foisted off on him to some fool from Greenwood, who couldn't tell the difference between a decent shotgun and a piece of corroded junk. He insisted on loaning Mama a little money, telling her that she was better than a bank for him. "You know how I am, Annie," he said. "If I keep cash, I'll just throw it away on nothing at all. If I give it to you, then come the time when I really need it, I know you'll give it back to me if you got it. And if you don't, well, then, at least you'll feed me. Won't you, little sister?" Daddy Glenn got mad at Mama for taking the money, as if she had done it just to prove he couldn't support us. He screamed at her that she had shamed him. "I'm a grown man," he yelled. "I don't need your damn brother to pay my way." He spent a week not speaking to any of us, and when Earl dropped by to visit, Daddy Glenn grumbled that he didn't have time to shoot the shit, and drove off like he had work to do. "Too much pride in that boy," Earl told Mama mildly. "If he don't lighten up a little, he's gonna rupture something. Hell, we all know we gotta help each other in this life." He winked at me, hugged Reese, and teased Mama till she giggled like a girl and made him a fried tomato sandwich. When he got ready to leave, he gave Reese a quarter and me a half dollar. "You're growing up, honey," Uncle Earl told me. "You're gonna be as pretty as your mama one of these days." I smiled and rolled that half dollar in my palms. Earl had lived alone since his wife left him, and he spent most of his evenings either out drinking or over at one of his sister's houses. Before Mama had decided she was going to marry Daddy Glenn, Uncle Earl was always around. But we saw less and less of him all the time. For a moment, then, I wished we lived with him, so Mama could take proper care of him, and he could give us coins and make Mama laugh. When Daddy Glenn came home late that night, he refused to go to bed, even though he had to work the next day. He sat out in the living room with the radio on, his expression fixed and angry. Mama sat up with him and tried to get him to talk, but he still wouldn't speak to her. When we got up the next morning, his face looked thin and white, and his blue eyes were so dark they looked black. The strained silence lasted for weeks, and even after it seemed to ease, Daddy Glenn was different. His face took on a brooding, sullen look. At dinner one night, I watched him shove his plate away angrily. "Nothing I do goes right," he complained. "I put my hand in a honey jar, and it comes out shit." "Oh, Glenn," Mama said. "Everybody has trouble now and again. Things will get better. Just give it time."
"Shut up,"
he screamed at her.
"Don't give me that Mama shit. Just shut up. Shut up."
Mama froze, one hand still lifted to reach toward the bread basket. Her face was like a photograph, black and white. Her eyes enormous dark shadows, and her skin bleached in that instant to a paper gloss, her open mouth stunned and gaping. Reese dropped her head down into her hands and gave a soft, thin cry that turned immediately to sobs. Without even thinking about it, I locked my fingers tight to the edge of the table and pushed myself up to a standing position. Daddy Glenn's face was red, swollen, tears running down his cheeks. Mama's eyes swept over to me like searchlights, and his followed.
"Oh, God,"
he moaned, and Mama shuddered. Daddy Glenn stumbled around the table, his hip thudding against the edge, shaking the bowls and glasses.
"Oh, Annie, I'm sorry. Oh, God, I don't want to be yelling at you."
He kissed her forehead, cheekbones, chin, his hands pressed to the sides of her face.
"Oh, Annie, I'm sorry."
"It's all right," she whispered, stroking his arms and trying to push him away. "It's all right, honey. I understand." Reese went on sobbing while I stood gripping the edge of the table, with no idea what I had been about to do. I looked down at my hands. My fingertips flattened and white,
my nails bitten off in ragged edges. My hands were still, but my arms were shaking. What had I been going to do?
What had I been going to do?
Daddy Glenn looked at me standing there.
I know how much your mama loves you,
he said, putting his hand on my arm, squeezing tight. When he let me go, there was a bruise, and Mama saw it right away.
Glenn, you don't know your own strength!
No.
He was calmer now. Guess I don't. But Bone knows I'd never mean to hurt her. Bone knows I love her, goddammit.
You know how I love you all, Annie.
I stared up at him, Mama's hands on my shoulders, knowing my mouth was hanging open and my face was blank. What did I know? What did I believe? I looked at his hands. No, he never meant to hurt me, not really, I told myself. But more and more, those hands seemed to move before he could think. His hands were big, impersonal, and fast. I could not avoid them. Reese and I made jokes about them when he wasn't around. Gorilla hands, monkey paws, paddlefish, beaver tails. Sometimes I worried if he knew the things we said. My dreams were full of long fingers, hands that reached around door frames and crept over the edge of the mattress. Fear in me like a river, like the ice dark blue of his eyes.
Chapter 6 Hunger makes you restless. You dream about food. Not just any food, but perfect food. The best food. Magical meals, famous and awe-inspiring. The one piece of meat, the exact taste of buttery corn. Tomatoes so ripe they split and sweeten the air. Beans so crisp they snap between the teeth. Gravy like mother's milk singing to your bloodstream. When I got hungry, my hands would not stay still. I would pick at the edges of scabs, scratch at chigger bites and old scars, and tug at loose strands of my black hair. I'd rock a penny in my palm, trying to learn to roll it one-handed up and around each finger without dropping it, the way my cousin Gray could. I'd chew my fingernails or suck on toothpicks and read everything I hadn't read more than twice already. But when Reese got hungry, and there was nothing to eat, she would just sob, shiny, fat tears running down her pink cheeks. Nothing would distract her. We weren't hungry too often. There was always something that could be done. Reese and I walked the side of the highway, picking up return deposit bottles to cash in and buy Mama cigarettes while she gave home permanence to the old ladies she knew from the lunch counter. Reese would wrinkle her nose and giggle as she slipped the pack of Pall Malls into Mama's pocket, while I ran to get us a couple of biscuits out of the towel-wrapped dish on the stove. Such fine little ladies, the women would tell her, and Mama would pat her pocket and agree. Mama knew how to make a meal of biscuits and gravy. Flour and water biscuits with bacon fat gravy to pour over them. By the time I started the fourth grade, we were eating biscuit dinners more often than not. Sometimes with the biscuits, Mama would serve a bowl of tomato soup or cold pork and beans. We joked about licking it right out of the can, but it was cold because the power company had turned the house off. No money in the mail, no electricity. That was hunger wrapped around a starched belly. One afternoon, there was not even flour to make up the pretense of a meal. We sat at the kitchen table, Reese and I grumbling over our rumbling bellies. Mama laughed, but kept her face turned away from us. Making so much noise over so little. You think you girls hadn't been fed in a week? She got out soda crackers and began to spread them with a layer of dark red ketchup spotted with salt and pepper. She poured us glasses of cold tea and told us stories about real hunger. Hunger of days with no expectation that there would ever be biscuits again. How when she was a kid, she'd wrestle her sisters for the last bacon rind. We used to pass the plates around the table. 8 plates for 8 kids, pretending there was food gonna come off the stove to fill those plates. Talking about food we'd never seen, just heard about or imagined. Making up stories about what we'd cook if we could. Earl liked the idea of parboiled puppies. Your Aunt Ruth always talked about frogs' tongues with dewberries. Beau wanted fried rutabagas, and Neville cried for steamed daffodils.
But Raylene won the prize with her recipe for sugar-glazed turtle meat with poison greens and hot piss dressing.
After a while, Reese and I started making up our own pretend meals. Peanut butter and Jell-O, mashed bug meat with pickles. Mama made us laugh with her imitations of her brothers and sisters fighting over the most disgusting meals they could dream up. She filled our stomachs with soda crackers and ketchup, soda crackers and mayonnaise, and more big glasses of tea. All the time laughing and teasing and tickling our shoulders with her long nails as she walked back and forth. Reese finally went outside to chase the dogs from next door and yell insults at the boys who ran them. But I stayed back to watch Mama through the kitchen window, to see her fingers ridge up into fists and her chin stand out in anger. When Daddy Glenn came back from fishing with my uncles, she was just like a big, angry mama hen, feathers up and eyes yellow.
"Soda crackers and ketchup?" she hissed at him. "You so casual about finding another job, but I had to feed my girls that shit while you sat on your butt all afternoon, smoking and telling lies."
She shoved her hands under her arms and sucked her lips in tight so that her mouth looked flat and hard.
"Now, Annie."
Daddy Glenn reached out to touch her arm. She slapped his hand down and jumped back like a snake that's caught a rat. I backed away from the window and ran around to the side of the house to watch from the open door to the driveway. I had never seen Mama like that. It was scary, but wonderful, too. She didn't seem to be afraid of anything.
"Not my kids,"
she told Daddy Glenn, her voice carrying like a shout, though she was speaking in a hoarse whisper.
"I was never gonna have my kids know what it was like. Never was gonna have them hungry or cold or scared. Never. You hear me? Never."
She went into the bathroom and washed her face, her underarms, and her neck. Mama was pulling her hose carefully up her legs when I ran in to stand beside her, too scared and excited not to stay close. She paused to hug me briefly.
"Go call and have your Uncle Earl come by here to pick you up when he gets off. You and Reese better stay at your Aunt Alma's place till I get back."
I ran out to the kitchen, where the phone was, but didn't call. Instead, I hung back in the doorway and watched her reflection in the mirror down the hall. Mama put on a clean bra and one of the sleeveless red pullover sweaters she'd gotten from her friend Mab down at the diner, the one Mab joked was made to show just how high her tits could point. Daddy Glenn came to the doorway and stood watching her with his throat working, but no sound coming out. Mama outlined her mouth in bold red lipstick, combed back her dark blonde hair, and hung her big old purse on one arm. She glanced up the hall and saw me leaning against the kitchen doorway.
"Did you call Earl?"
I nodded, uneasy at lying, but not wanted to upset her. It would be hours before Earl would be free to come get us, and I'd already decided not to wait for him. Mama paused, shook her head, walked back to the bedroom, and reached under the bedframe to pull out the box where she stored her shiny black patent leather high heels. When she stood up in those, she looked like a different person, older and harder, her mouth set in a grim little smile. Her blonde hair looked even brighter, her eyes darker, her complexion paler. She was coldly beautiful. Daddy Glenn was still standing in the hall, but Mama stepped around him as if there wasn't really anyone there, as if cocking her hip and swinging to one side were just a normal part of walking down the hall. Daddy Glenn swayed a bit as she passed, but did not move to stop her. His hands hung along his pockets while he breathed through his mouth like he was going to be sick. Her heels clicking on the floor were almost as loud as the cracking of his knuckles where he stood. I followed closely behind Mama, afraid to look back at Daddy Glenn, afraid my glance might break the spell that seemed to be holding him in the hallway. Mama said nothing, just gave me a hug and a kiss, and slid behind the wheel of her Pontiac. When the car engine roared, the spell broke. Daddy Glenn ran out and stood on the tarmac watching Mama drive away. His face was rigid. He didn't even look in my direction, but my belly crawled up tight against my backbone. I felt as if the grass had turned to ammonia and was burning in my throat, as if Daddy Glenn's skin was radiating red heat and waves of steamy sweat. Around the narrow straps of his sleeveless t-shirt, I watched the muscles in his shoulders roll and bunch.
I knew he could easily break my arms as methodically as he was cracking his knuckles, wring my neck as hard as he was wringing his hands. I backed up carefully, then ran around the house, climbing the fence between our yard and the neighbor's so I couldn't be seen. Reese was jumping rope with the McCauley twins and didn't want to go with me, but she cheered up when I told her we would walk to the highway and hitchhike instead of calling for a lift. Reese loved flagging down strangers on the highway and begging a ride the 4 miles over to where Aunt Alma lived. She had promised me she would never do it without me, but I worried that as soon as she was a little older, she would be hitchhiking all over the county. So every time we hitched a ride, I made up a new horror story. The habit was so strong in me that, nervous as I was, I automatically started another one. This time, about the phantom driver who went around picking up girls and skinned them like young deer, eating the meat and tanning their hides to make coin purses and pocketbooks. "He'll never get us," Reese laughed. "We just have to be careful never to take a ride with a man alone." I thought about that for a moment. "Well, it ain't so easy to know who the phantom is," I told Reese. "Sometimes he catches a married couple first, hiding in the back of their car while they're in the gas station bathroom. When they drive off, first he murders them, and then he props them up so you'd think they were the only people in the car. That way, he catches lots of people who would never get in a car with a man alone." Reese chewed her lower lip and stared up the highway. I could see she was thinking this new information over carefully. She examined the people in the truck that stopped for us. An elderly woman in a dark blue shirtwaist dress, and a younger man in khaki work clothes. Before climbing in back, she slapped the side of the cab hard enough to see both of them jump in their seats. I bit my tongue to keep from laughing. The old lady scolded us for catching a ride on the highway. "You could get killed or worse," she told us through the back window. "Young girls on the roads are an invitation to the wicked. Anything could happen to you." We both nodded solemnly and thanked her politely when we jumped off just down the road from Aunt Alma's place. It was past midnight when Mama came for us. Reese was asleep in Aunt Alma's bed, but I was sitting up with Uncle Wade, nodding over the picture puzzle he worked at when he couldn't sleep. "Girl, your Mama," he said, giving me a little push. I jerked fully awake when Mama touched my shoulder. Her hands were heavy and smelled faintly of Jergens lotion. "Come on, Bone," she whispered. "We're going home." She thanked Uncle Wade in a tired voice. Her hair was limp, and her face scrubbed clean. She was still wearing that pullover sweater, but she'd added a loose white shirt and changed back to her waitress flats. "Don't talk," she told me. "Just get Reese's shoes and come on." She lifted Reese without disturbing Aunt Alma and carried her out to the car. I followed her, holding on to her right side, while Reese leaned into her left shoulder. At the car, she paused and looked up into the dark night sky. In the light from the house, her face was all hollows and angles, her eyes sunken and glittery. "Damn," she whispered softly, and leaned her forehead against the cool metal above the car door. "Damn, damn." "Mama," Reese whimpered. I pressed my cheek against Mama's side and kept still. There was a long, cold moment while we waited, and then Mama pushed herself back up straight and opened the door. "All right," she said, as if she were wrapping up some long conversation with herself. "All right." I looked back to Aunt Alma's house. Uncle Wade was standing in the kitchen looking out at us, his face stern and his mouth hard. Why was he angry? I wondered. What could have made him look so terribly angry? "Cook you some eggs," Mama said as she steered us into the kitchen and sat us at the table. There was flour in a can, a jar of jelly, butter in a dish, a bag of tomatoes, fatback in a sealed package, and a carton of fresh eggs all speckled brown. She put most of it away and then whipped the eggs up with sweet milk, laying slices of green tomato to fry around the sides of the pan before she poured the eggs in. "My Mama used to cook this late at night," she announced, blinking in the too bright light. Daddy Glenn was sitting in the living room in front of the television set with the sound turned down low, not looking at us and not speaking.
I watched Reese's eyes flicker toward him, and then back to Mama and over to me. Daddy Glenn's hands kept moving on his thighs, the fingers working into knots, tightening on his trousers, and then shaking against the dark fabric like the legs of dying June bugs turned belly up in the night. Mama pulled a tray of biscuits out of the oven and grinned at us.
You got to get the tomatoes almost done before you put the eggs in, 'cause you don't cook the eggs much at all. Want them soft. Want them to melt like butter between your teeth and your tongue.
She spooned me out a scoop of eggs and put two biscuits on the plate next to the soft browned tomatoes. Reese spread butter on her biscuits and poured a big dollop of jelly next to her eggs. My stomach was so tight, I didn't see how I could eat. But Mama sat right across from me and smiled so wide, I knew I had to eat it all. I did, slowly, while Daddy Glenn sat silent in the next room, and Mama went on talking like he wasn't there at all. My eyes kept sliding over to where his hands gripped his thighs. I curled mine under the table, rubbed my leg muscles. The biscuits stuffed me, but didn't satisfy. Once I started eating, I could not get full. Reese seemed to feel the same way. She ate until her eyes looked swollen shut from too much food. Then she lay her face down on the table, as if she were going to nap right there. Mama smiled at her and reached over to tuck her lank blonde hair behind her ears, where it couldn't fall in her eyes. She buttered all the biscuits that were left and wrapped them in a towel to keep for morning. All the time, she went on talking about nothing in particular. About her mama and meals she had watched her aunts cook up late at night. About a noise the Pontiac had started to make, and how she really needed to clean out the trap on the washing machine. I listened to Mama with my mouth open. It felt like there was a wind blowing from my neck down to my belly, hot and chill at the same time, dropping little sparks into my nervous system. Finally, Mama put Reese and me to bed together, sitting up beside us as if she were going to spend all night there. I could hear the television set still playing softly in the front room, and I tried to stay awake, but the food was like a drug in my system. I slid off into the dark and a dream of great soft strangling clouds lying like fog banks on a field of blackberries. I woke up to Reese's swollen, frightened face and the low, angry sound of Daddy Glenn's voice down the hall. I linked my fingers with Reese's and prayed for silence, closing my eyes so tight my ears buzzed. We had to move again that next week, but Mama said the new place would be better now that Daddy Glenn was going to be working out at the Pepsi plant. But the new house wasn't new. It looked just like the last three, small and close and damp smelling no matter how many times Mama aired it out. It was just like all the houses Daddy Glenn had found for us, tract houses with white slatted walls and tin-roofed carports. The lawns were dry, with coarse, straggly grass and scattered patches of rocky ground. There were never any trees or bushes. Mama would sometimes put in flowers or spade up a patch in the back for vegetables that somehow never got planted before we would move again. But the houses always looked naked and abandoned.
Unloved,
Temple, Aunt Alma's oldest girl, told me while helping us unpack in the new bedroom. Your daddy's always finding you houses where it looks like nobody ever really wanted to live. This place looks like people just stopped in and left as fast as they could. I didn't argue. She was right. My aunts were always moving, too. All of them but Aunt Raylene, who had rented the same house for most of her adult life. No one else seemed to stay any one place very long, but the houses they chose were older ones that tended to resemble each other. Not like the ones Daddy Glenn wanted, with the jalousy windows, carports, and garbage disposals that never worked. Alma always lived in big old rickety houses, with wide porches and dogs lying out flat in the sun. Aunt Ruth liked the ones that had black walnut trees to spread shade over my uncle's pickup trucks. Daddy Glenn sneered at my aunt's houses with their coal grate fireplaces and chicken coops in the backyard. I wouldn't live in your place if you paid me, he swore to Travis one Sunday. But Travis just grinned and gave him a shove. The problem is, Glenn boy, you got to pay them landlords.
And hell, they don't care what we think about nothing, what kind of place we think we want to rent. Shit. We all do what we can, you know?
I loved it when Alma and Wade moved out to the country, next to wide, flat fields of peanuts and strawberries. It was just past the edge of town, near the West Greenville truck routes, where everything was run down and cheap, and nobody minded if you parked your car on the grass. There were always kids on the porch, cousins going in and out of screen doors, laundry hanging out back, and chickens running around. And no matter which aunt we visited, there was always something to do.
"Catch me that hen," Aunt Alma would tell me. "Then pick over these beans and wash those tomatoes."
Reese would help. We would sit out on the porch together, blending in with the cousins and their friends so completely that sometimes Aunt Alma or Aunt Ruth would forget we were there until Mama called looking for us. It didn't matter where we were living, so long as we could go stay with one of our aunts. Over at Aunt Alma's, we could listen to Garvey and Gray fight, to little Earl giggle and squeak, to Uncle Wade drink and cuss, to the radio playing and the chickens clucking outside the windows. Over there, we got to slide around on a big tarp with the sprinkler shooting cold water up in a shower. At Aunt Ruth's, we could watch Uncle Travis cut up potatoes for her, a beer at his side and a cigarette dangling from one side of his mouth, ashes occasionally dropping into the peels. Aunt Ruth even let us play in just our panties, though after Reese got ringworm, Mama insisted we keep our clothes on, and after we got chiggers, she made us scrub down as soon as we came home. Reese and I didn't mind. We still wanted to go visiting at every chance. I was alive over at the aunts' houses, warm, always humming with voices and laughter and children running around. The quiet in our house was cold. No matter that we had a better furnace and didn't leave our doors open for the wind to blow through. There was something icy in Daddy Glenn's houses that melted out of us when we were over at our aunt's. Daddy Glenn's brothers lived in big houses they owned, with fenced-in yards and flowering bushes.
"This is how people ought to live,"
he told us when he drove us over to visit his brothers. More than anything, Daddy Glenn wanted a house like Daryl and James had, a new house with a nice lawn and picture windows framed in lined curtains. The houses he chose for us were always shabby imitations. Mama sewed curtains, washed windows, and polished floors. Daddy Glenn mowed the grass and sent us out with scissors to dig up the weeds along the driveway. He yelled at Earl and Beau if they drove up on the grass, and he chased the dogs that came and knocked over our garbage cans in the night.
"Nobody wants me to have nothing nice,"
he'd complain, and then get in one of his dangerously quiet moods and refuse to talk to anybody. He brooded so much, Reese and I patrolled the yard, picking up windblown trash and dog turds, anything that would make him mad. Every new house made him happy for a little while, and we tried to extend that period of relative calm as much as possible, keeping everything sparkling clean and neat.
"Things are gonna be different here," he'd tell Mama.
Reese and I would keep our faces expressionless and stay out of his way. Neither of us believed things would ever change, but we knew better than to say so. Sometimes it seemed Daddy Glenn could almost read the thoughts we were trying to hide, catch us with his eyes, thinking that nothing he did was going to make any difference.
"It eats a man's heart out,"
he told Mama one time,
"knowing no one trusts him."
It seemed our unbelief was what made him fail. Our lack of faith made him the man he was, made him go out to work unable to avoid getting in a fight, made him sarcastic to his bosses and nasty to the shop owners he was supposed to be persuading to take his accounts. Money would get tighter, and Daddy Glenn would stare at us like we cost him cash with every breath we took. The rent would be late one month, impossible the next, and late again after that. Daddy Glenn started going for long drives in the evening, and people started coming to the door during the day. They'd bang on the jam after ringing the bell. If Mama was home, she would sit at the kitchen table with a cigarette between her fingers, staring off into space and saying nothing. Reese or I would go to the door and yell out, "Mama's not to home. I can't let you in. My mama's not to home." The men and women who came to our door would wheedle and threaten, cajole and rage. They'd call Mama's name so loud all the neighbors could hear. Mama would push her hair straight back from her face, light another cigarette, and hug us. Reese and I would grin and look carefully out from under the curtains to be sure the landlord or the bill collector had gone, and then run back to tell her. "My smart girls," Mama would praise us. "My strong, smart girls." Her face would relax then. The sharp lines of her eyebrows would soften, and she would pull us up close to her one more time, every time. "We're not bad people," Mama told us. "We're not even really poor. Anybody says something to you, you keep that in mind. We're not bad people, and we pay our way. We just can't always pay when people want." Reese and I nodded earnestly, agreeing wordlessly, but we didn't believe her. We knew what the neighbors called us, what Mama wanted to protect us from. We knew who we were. Uncle Neville and Aunt Faye got a place on such a steep hill that we could play in the dirt under the front porch with the dogs. When we stood on tiptoe, we could barely reach the floorboards above us. The house was set so deep in the hill that the dogs could not dig out from under it, and the back rooms were always cool and shadowy. I loved that house. The cool dimness under the porch, ripe with the smell of dogs and red dirt. But Daddy Glenn hated it.
"It's a goddamn nigger shanty. Don't they care how they're living?"
He wouldn't put us in such a house, he insisted. He moved us instead to a cinder block house where the tile floors were always peeling up in the damp and where we didn't stay very long anyway.
"But a decent neighborhood,"
he told Mama, who said nothing, just unpacked the dishes one more time. My Aunt Alma earned Daddy Glenn's undying contempt the year I was 9, and she moved out on my Uncle Wade. Uncle Earl joked that Alma had finally caught Wade doing just what he'd been doing for years. "Messing around," Cousin Dee Dee said. "If he was my husband, I'd shoot his dick off." "Might be a factor in why you don't have one. A husband, that is," Aunt Alma told her, and then laughed at the idea of shooting Uncle Wade in his private parts. "It'd get his attention, anyway," she told Mama. "But hell, the man's a dog. Don't care where he sticks it. Don't know the value of what he had. Might as well take myself out of reach of his dirty ways." She moved her brood of kids into an apartment building downtown, a second-floor frame walk-up with a shaky wide porch hanging off one side. No matter where she lived, Alma always had a porch. Nobody else we knew had ever lived in an apartment. Mama took us over to visit with a paper sack of towels and cotton diapers for the new baby from the Salvation Army thrift store. Aunt Alma smiled to see her, pulled a pitcher of cold tea out of the icebox, and shooed us out on the porch. A long flight of steps ran off the porch and looped back past the lower apartment extending down to the yard. Gray and little Earl were sitting on the top steps, leaning over to watch the kids from downstairs, who were looking out their windows up to where we all stood. Shiny brown faces kept pressing against the glass, and then withdrawing. Stern, blank faces that we could barely tell one from the other. "Niggers," Gray whispered proudly. "Scared of us." I wrapped my fingers around the banister rail, working splinters loose from the dry wood, and leaned over to look for myself. I had never seen colored people up close, and I was curious about these. They did look scared. "Their mama won't let them come out." Little Earl was chewing a splinter off the railing and picking at another. "We heard her this morning, telling them she'd beat their asses if they even opened that door. She sure ain't happy we moved in here." "Well, neither is Daddy," Gray laughed. "Must be hot cooped up in there," Patsy Ruth whispered. I nodded, still watching the window. It looked like there were three of them down there, taking turns looking out, fully fascinated with us as we were with them. Reese came up behind me and pulled at my arm. I didn't turn. It seemed as if the face in the window was looking at me. "Can't we go down in the yard?" "It's hotter down there. No breeze at all, and dusty.
better up here.
Gray spat over the rail, to the parched, bare ground far below.
Besides, we'd have to go past them.
He nodded at the window. I slit my eyes against the bright light. The face in the window narrowed its eyes. I couldn't tell if it was a boy or a girl.
A very pretty boy or a very fierce girl, for sure.
The cheekbones were as high as mine, the eyes large and delicate with long lashes, while the mouth was small, the lips puffy as if bee-stung, but not wide. The chocolate skin was so smooth, so polished, the pores invisible. I put my fingers up to my cheeks, looked over at Gray, and then back down. Gray's cheeks were pitted with blackheads and flushed with sunburn. I'd never thought about it before, but he was almost ugly.
What are you staring at, Bone?
Gray poked me. I couldn't say what I was thinking. Couldn't say,
that child is prettier than you.
I pulled myself back from the railing and tore off a splinter of my own before turning to look into Gray's face. I like it here. Like it a lot better than that rickety old place where you were living before, I lied. How many bedrooms you got? Gray's face relaxed, and I realized he had been afraid I was going to say something nasty.
More room here than it looks like. Got a room just for little Earl and Tadpole and me. Patsy, Ruth, and Temple got their own. And Mama even said I could keep a tank on the dresser and get my turtles back from Garvey.
Little Earl nodded enthusiastically. It was the first time anyone had mentioned Garvey, who had stayed with Uncle Wade. But I said nothing. Mama had told me it caused a terrible fight when Wade kept Garvey and let his twin go on with Aunt Alma.
Don't call the baby Tadpole,
Patsy Ruth interrupted.
Call her Annie. You know Mama hates it when you call her Tadpole.
The door opened, and Aunt Alma looked out.
You kids playing good?
She squinted against the sun.
No problem, Mama, Gray told her.
I looked down to the window below us again. It was a girl, I was almost sure. A fierce girl watching us distrustfully. Gray pulled himself up from the steps with one big hand. The girl's eyes followed his fist and then looked back to me. I tried to smile, but my face felt stiff, nervous. The girl's face remained expressionless and pulled back into the darkness of the apartment.
Don't you be mean to those kids downstairs,
Aunt Alma told Gray.
I don't want no trouble with these people.
Yes, Mama,
Gray and little Earl echoed. The window below stayed dark. The next time we went over to visit, Gray told me there were 5 of them downstairs, same as upstairs, with the daddy off working up north and none of the kids as old as he was. The woman kept to herself, wouldn't do more than nod to Aunt Alma. But the kids started hanging out on the steps again after the first week, running inside whenever one of the uncle's trucks pulled up, but otherwise ignoring the white children. Sometime in the second week, they held a spitting contest, upstairs against down, and Gray won. After that, things got a little easier. Gray showed his pocket knife to the boys downstairs, and in turn admired a set of tools the oldest boy had from his father. It was only the girl who kept herself aloof, staying with her mama while the boys played out in the yard.
She's pretty, if niggers can be pretty, Gray told me, but not friendly. Looks like she expects me to bite her neck or something.
You call her that and she might bite you.
I would.
I was remembering the girl's intent, determined face. I had heard all the hateful jokes and nasty things people said about niggers, but on my own, I had never before spoken to a colored person in anything more than the brief, careful sir and ma'am that Mama had taught us. I was as shy with those kids as they seemed to be with us. As nervous as the idea made me, I wished that girl would come out so I could try to talk to her. But she never did more than look out the window at us. Her mama had probably told her all about what to expect from trash like us.
Boy, howdy, you should have heard what Daddy and Uncle Bo said when they came over. The things they called them.
Gray frowned and kicked one foot against the other.
Daddy's awful mad we moved in here.
I knew what he meant. Uncle Wade and Aunt Alma had been over at our place the week before.
Wade looking worn down and shabby and cursing Alma to her face.
Running off with a man's children, living in that dirty place with niggers all around. My little girl's having to go up those stairs past those nigger boys.